Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jeanette Jalil, and in the early hours of Saturday, October the 5th, these are our main stories. Donald Trump toughs it out as fresh allegations swirl around his presidency. Clashes on the streets of Hong Kong as a new ban on face masks comes into force. And in Britain, Prince Harry takes on the tabloids in his battle for privacy. Also in this podcast, a rare bit of good news from the front line in the battle against Ebola.
I was very fearful, but was looked after very well. Doctors and nurses were constantly checking on me until I was well enough to be discharged.
Tunisians return to the polls, but how much enthusiasm do they still have for their fledgling democracy? And has online dating taken the romance out of finding a partner?
We have started to treat the dating world like our shopping. And I know I'm not alone. I've got a friend in LA, a friend in Sydney. We were all doing it and all talking to each other about who we were meeting and what we were doing.
But first, US Republicans have mostly remained silent as the impeachment inquiry launched last week against President Trump has gathered steam. But one senior figure, the former presidential candidate Mitt Romney, has now spoken out, saying it was wrong and appalling for Mr. Trump to have pushed Ukraine and China to investigate his Democratic political rival Joe Biden. Mr. Trump himself, though, is doubling down, saying that he has a duty to root out corruption, even if it means asking for foreign help.
If a foreign country can help us with respect to corruption and corruption probes, and that, I don't care if it's Biden or anybody else, but if they can help us, if Biden is corrupt, if his son is corrupt, anything having to do with corruption, I actually feel I have an obligation to do that.
Our correspondent in Washington, Gary O'Donoghue, says Mr. Trump has been constantly shifting tactics to deal with the allegations swirling around him.
There have been a sort of number of approaches that he's taken since this impeachment story took off. It started off, his explanation was that he wanted to make sure that other countries paid as much to Ukraine as America did, and that's why he was withholding money, etc. And then it went through the business of corruption inside Ukraine itself, and that was the reason. And then it went to the business of wanting them to look at Joe Biden and his son. So there have been a number of iterations, but you've got an interesting strategy here where he is trying to embrace the behaviour, if you like, trying to own it, trying to say, yeah, no, it's fine. And what's more, I'm going to ask China to do it as well, openly. And it's not just something I'm allowed to do, it's something I have an obligation to do, if you like.
And meanwhile, the impeachment inquiry launched by the Democrats is moving at a dizzying pace. What are the latest developments?
Oh, yeah, they're keeping up the pace. Lots of details of some of the depositions coming out, the text messages, of course, that came out last night here on Thursday in Washington, detailing the to and fro from those diplomats over the summer, over the wish for the Ukrainians to have a meeting with the president, over the president wanting them to make a statement about investigating the company that Joe Biden's son had been involved in. Today we've had, I think, perhaps the strongest condemnation of President Trump by a Republican, by a senior Republican so far, and that they've been very quiet in the Senate, but Mitt Romney, the man who ran for president, describing the business of asking for the investigation into Joe Biden as appalling. That's the strongest we've had so far from a Republican.
So how bad is it looking for President Trump? My colleague Julian Marshall has been talking to the Republican strategist Taylor Griffin, who worked as an aide to former President George W. Bush.
It's grown significantly worse for President Trump this week. There have been a lot of scandals around President Trump. And so most people sort of have their minds made up about whether or not they think Trump is ethical or a crook or whether he's a hero. And it's going to take a lot to move opinions on that. And because impeachment is an inherently political process, without the support of the American people, it doesn't mean much and could even backfire on Democrats. I think the text messages and the very clear indication within them that President Trump and his team were using the levers of the power of the office of the presidency to extract help for a personal political favor in damaging the president's 2020 rival have significantly worsened or deepened the case that Trump now has to defend himself against in terms of impeachment.
But those texts in themselves, were they evidence of a quid pro quo?
It certainly seems highly suggestive. The entire conversation around putting a call together between Trump and Zelensky seems to have been based around the extent to which Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, would acquiesce to Trump's demands for an investigation. And that's important because if there's not a real quid pro quo, if it's just Trump asking a favor of someone, of a foreign leader, that's bad. But it's not necessarily impeachment bad in a lot of Americans' point of view. But if he is leveraging the bilateral relations of the United States with an important country like Ukraine in order to extract political favors, that is significantly worse. I think that's what these text messages tend to indicate.
We also have this development whereby it seems that Ukraine is actually now inclined to investigate the allegations against Joe Biden and his son. How much hope is the White House putting in that?
I think the White House is putting a lot of hope in just the idea that there's an investigation and that there may be something bad about Joe Biden. That's really what they're invested in. What the specifics of it are not as important as the idea that Joe Biden may not be squeaky clean, because Joe Biden's primary appeal as a candidate is an alternative to Trump that people can invest trust in, that Joe Biden, you know, may not be the most exciting candidate. He may not be lighting the world on fire, but he is a guy who's honest, ethical, forthright. And so I'd prefer that to the sort of circus that we have under Donald Trump. But if you start to tarnish that and people start to see Biden as kind of just trading one crazy, potentially corrupt politician for another, that may work to Trump's advantage, because people who are thinking about maybe switching to Biden, swing voters, might say, well, the economy's pretty good. I just might as well stick with Trump because maybe Biden doesn't make things much better.
The Republican Party strategist Taylor Griffin. A face mask ban is now in force in Hong Kong. That's the sound of tear gas canisters being fired in response to protests after Hong Kong's political leader Carrie Lam announced the ban. It's based on an emergency colonial era law. Our correspondent in Hong Kong is Robin Brandt.
I'm in an area of the city called Mong Kok, which is on the Kowloon side. So it's the part of Hong Kong that's attached to mainland China. We've seen some police activity tonight. They've cleared a barricade on a road just in front of me. I'm at an intersection by an underpass. The police came in, they cleared it, the protesters were dispersed. But frankly, it's a good example of what we're seeing in lots of places tonight, which is kind of cat and mouse between the authorities and the protesters. No violent confrontation. There have been other incidents, though, in Hong Kong this evening where tear gas has been fired. We've had a teenager shot in the leg, reportedly. All of this is in the context of two significant events on Friday. Firstly, Hong Kong's metro system was completely shut down. That's never happened before. And that's evidence of an escalation by the authorities to try and make it much more difficult for these protesters to get around. And then secondly, this ban on masks, ban on face coverings for anyone at these protests is in place. That means that it's now illegal to wear a mask, to wear face paint, anything that's going to be seen as an attempt to conceal your identity if you're out protesting at these events. Most of these events are deemed illegal by the police.
This is an attempt by Carrie Lam, the Hong Kong political leader, to get tough, but it does seem to have backfired. Why are protesters so angry about this face mask ban?
Well, you're right. I think we've seen evidence tonight in two instances, as I've just touched on, of an escalation by the authorities to try and at the very least quell these protests. They're using this emergency ordinance. Effectively, it goes back to the colonial era, which gives them the right, the government says, to impose these emergency conditions in times of real civil emergency. There was an attempt, a judicial attempt by the protesters to challenge that. That was unsuccessful. We saw people on the streets immediately when this was announced. in their hundreds and thousands, most of them with their faces covered. The big problem for the authorities is going to be, how do you enforce this? Remember, we've seen at one point almost 2 million people on the streets here. The defiance continues, the defiance goes on, and we are now 4 months into this.
Robin Brandt in Hong Kong. Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe is a British-Iranian woman arrested in Iran and sentenced to 5 years in prison for spying, a charge she's always vehemently denied. Her imprisonment has seen her endure hunger strikes and solitary confinement and provoked a major diplomatic row between London and Tehran. Her daughter, Gabriella, who's now five, was with her when she was arrested in 2016. Since then, she's been living with Nazanin's parents in Tehran, visiting her mother in prison once a week. But Nazanin's British husband, Richard Ratcliffe, who's campaigned tirelessly for his wife's release, says he believes the time is now right for Gabriella to return to the UK.
She's obviously of an age now where she should be going to school. We had been talking about it for a while, that if we got to school age and things hadn't moved, we tried long enough to bring them both home together, then we'll bring Gabriella home. She's of an age now where she does understand things. She starts to ask more questions and, yeah, her future's here.
And your wife has agreed?
Yeah, Nazanin's agreed. With a heavy heart, I think it's fair to say. It's something that we talked about for a long time. And in fact, when Gabriella did turn five, then Nazanin went on hunger strike, has then been in a mental hospital, and then we've had banned a phone call. So that it's taken a long time since the turning five to actually agreeing finally now.
I mean, I don't know when the letter was written, but one published online in Farsi and English quotes her as saying, "I have no hope or motivation after my baby goes. There's no measure to my pain."
Yeah, that's right. It's a very bleak letter, and I think it's a fair reflection of how she's feeling. And the part of that is just the despair of being in prison and unfairly held in this way. But part of it's also the fact that her lifeline is seeing Gabriella, and you know, that'll be taken away.
Because that's been incredibly important to her, those weekly visits.
Been really important, that sort of little moment of normality. And, you know, I mean, Gabriella will come along and sit on her lap and they'll do drawings together. And just the ways in which all the other stuff that's going on, it's being mummy again.
When did you last speak to Nazanin?
So when I spoke to Nazanin on Wednesday, there was a period where phone calls were banned, but they've resumed again. Yeah, she was pretty flat.
Has there been any movement at all on the diplomatic front under the new government of Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab?
I mean, I think if I'm honest, it always feels with a new government there's a step back because you need to build new relations and new ways of seeing things. Obviously, the Prime Minister met with President Rouhani last week in New York at the UN, and Nazanin's case was raised. I don't get the sense, and from talking to the British ambassador, that things have moved forwards particularly positively.
I mean, what would unlock it? What would lead to the release of your wife?
Well, the Iranian foreign minister was very, very blunt last week and said, listen, if there was progress on a case between the UK and Iran over some money, then there could be progress on Nazanin's case. There was clearly a hawking of potential solutions, and we'll see.
Richard Ratcliffe speaking to my colleague Julian Marshall about his wife Nazanin, who's been imprisoned in Iran for more than 3 years. Tunisia, the country at the forefront of the Arab Spring 8 years ago, is marking another democratic milestone. Polls this weekend for multi-party parliamentary elections will be followed on Sunday week by the second round of the presidential election. But despite these milestones, many Tunisians seem to be increasingly cynical about their politicians and even disenchanted with the whole idea of democracy itself, as the BBC's Paul Moss now reports.
It felt rather like being at a religious revival meeting in an upstairs hall in the provincial Tunisian town of Ras Jebel. Campaigners for the Heart of Tunisia party were promising something close to heaven on earth if only locals would send votes their way. Heart of Tunisia is a relatively new political party, led by the multi-millionaire owner of a television station, Nabil Karawi. Mr. Karawi is currently being held in jail, accused of tax evasion and money laundering. Yet he has still managed to get through to the final two in Tunisia's presidential election. And his party is top of some polls in the general election, winning over supporters with its claim to be the anti-establishment option.
It's coming like a new way of guiding the country. We feel fed up of the old parties, old ways, and I feel that they can make the country the right way.
Why are you supporting the Heart of Tunisia party?
Oh my God! It's going to create the Tunisia of our dream. The Tunisia that would have no limit in the future.
There are plenty of prime ministers and presidents who've gained power in different countries in recent years by claiming to be anti-establishment outsiders. But Tunisian democracy is less than a decade old. It might seem just a little premature to be even speaking about a political establishment here.
And yet you meet plenty of enthusiastic people here trying to encourage Tunisians to keep faith with elections and the democratic process, like the NGO Al Balsala, which means the compass.
Here we are watching the live streaming of a parliamentary commission meeting.
Nesrine Jalalia was showing me how her team live stream all parliamentary sessions on a Facebook page and then give anyone the chance to join in an online conversation.
Here there is someone commenting, nothing is going to change. There are also people who pick up on what one of the MPs have said or one of the lobbyists.
We could just pause it for a second. Let me ask you what you're hoping to achieve by doing this.
Is to make sure that everyone knows what the MPs are doing, but also for these politicians to at least know that they are constantly being watched. We will have to make this democracy work. There is no other choice.
Mahzia Labidi seems to be enjoying democracy right now. She's a member of parliament for Ennahda, the Islamist party, which has been part of Tunisia's coalition government, and which, like the others, has seen its support plummet. I caught up with her out campaigning on the streets of Grimalia, a rather dusty old town an hour's drive from the capital, Tunis. You look like you're having fun campaigning. I don't think I've ever seen a candidate spend so much time laughing and smiling.
This is why we speak with people, we laugh, we joke, and even if they are not interested in voting for me and for my list, the main thing is that they can vote.
Well, you say that, but there is a lot of disillusionment with democracy in Tunisia at the moment. Turnout at elections has dropped. What's gone wrong?
The fruits of democracy has not been harvested by the people. They are still waiting employment, they are still waiting health care, better education. But I'm sure that if ever given the opportunity to choose between liberty, democracy and despotism, Tunisian will choose again and again democracy and freedom.
Ennahda MP Mahzia Labidi ending that report from Tunisia by Paul Moss. Still to come, mixed reviews over attempts by a leading London theatre to cut the queue for the ladies' toilets. Here in Britain, Prince Harry has begun legal action against two of the country's biggest newspapers, The Sun and The Daily Mirror, for alleged phone hacking. It's understood that the claims date back more than 10 years. Here's our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
Just as his Africa tour ends, a legal bombshell. Prince Harry is taking the publishers of the most popular newspapers in the land to court. News Group Newspapers, the owner of The Sun and the now closed News of the World, and Mirror Group Newspapers, the owner of The Mirror, The Sunday Mirror and The Sunday People, are the defendants. The case, says Buckingham Palace, concerns the interception of voicemails, the phone hacking scandal that saw the closure of the News of the World and the huge payouts to celebrities by both newspaper groups. The royal family rarely reaches for lawyers, but this is the second time this week that the Duke and Duchess have done just that. On Wednesday, Harry let rip at the tabloids, writing of a ruthless campaign against his wife. Now he's taking them to court with well-aired but still hugely embarrassing allegations.
Johnny Diamond reporting. Now to the Democratic Republic of Congo and a rare good news story about efforts to tackle the deadly Ebola virus.
Et notre millième vainqueur s'appelle Katungu Marguerite.
Health workers there applauding Marguerite Katunga, the 1,000th person in the DRC to have recovered from Ebola as she left hospital to return home. And for Marguerite, this is an unexpected new lease on life.
I had never seen anybody dying of Ebola before. It was the first time to have contact with the disease, so I wasn't sure if I would survive. I was very fearful. but was hopeful I would be okay because I'd sought medical attention in time. I was looked after very well. Doctors and nurses were constantly checking on me until I was well enough to be discharged. It gave me a lot of hope. It calmed me and made me believe that I could be healed. I can tell people that Ebola is real because I've witnessed it. I'd advise anybody who is feeling any slight sickness to go for blood testing so they can start medication and get healed. The first thing I'll do when I go home is to thank God and thank the doctors for my healing. I'm praying that I'll remain healthy and strong so I can get back to working on my farm.
Marguerite was one of the lucky ones. More than 2,000 people in the DRC have died from Ebola since this latest outbreak began just over a year ago. Gail Sindeli, who works for the UN's Ebola Response Unit in the Congo, was at the celebrations for Marguerite.
Today, I think it had a particular meaning for all the communities and for all the people who have Ebola to know that we are reaching such great numbers being cured. So I think it's these 1,000 survivors individually we need to rely on and we need to appreciate for all the hard work they're doing, speaking to their families and their communities. So it's definitely been an uphill battle. I think that's the right way to put it. But I think we're clearly seeing some progress. The number of cases is decreasing, especially here in North Kivu. Places like Beni and Butembo that were the heart of the disease and of the transmission barely have a few cases each week when it used to be several cases each day. The only thing is that we need to stay vigilant because what's happening is that the outbreak is moving north, so we still have cases and we still have transmission, and that we do not lose ground we've been gaining. So I think there's definitely an improvement. We've implemented some new strategies. We've been listening to the populations a lot more, I think, than was done before. So we've listened to their security concerns. We're listening to all their other concerns. We just have to make sure that we keep up the good work to actually put an end to this outbreak.
That was Gail Sindeli. A month is a very long time in politics, especially here in the UK right now. In September, the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, said he'd rather die in a ditch than ask for another delay to Brexit. But now, with less than 4 weeks to go until the UK is due to leave the European Union and still no sign of a deal, British government documents submitted to a Scottish court appear to show that Mr. Johnson will, after all, ask for a Brexit extension if no deal is reached within the next 2 weeks. Rob Watson is our political correspondent. I asked him if it was now clear what Boris Johnson was planning.
That is an easy question to answer, Jeanette, and the answer is, who knows? I mean, in many ways, you know, if everybody listening is horribly confused, don't worry. I think that's the only way to be, because I don't think anything is clear at all. And I don't think we're much the wiser after today's developments, because, yes, we hear that Mr. Johnson has said he will abide by the law and send a letter to Brussels asking for an extension to the Brexit process if a deal hasn't been agreed. But at the same time, he tweeted shortly afterwards, new deal or no deal, but no delay, get Brexit done, leave October 31st. So honestly, Jeanette, I don't think we're any the wiser.
Mr. Johnson has put forward his big Brexit plan this week, but so far there's been a pretty negative response from the European Union. Can a deal be reached in the next 2 weeks?
That's another easy one. Again, I'm afraid it's the same answer. This is getting rather repetitive, Jeanette. Forgive me. I mean, the short answer is, who knows? The initial signs from the EU aren't good. So we had a statement from the Commission saying that member states agreed the UK proposals do not provide a basis for concluding an agreement. But actually, I think it boils down to this, really. It's what will the EU consider to be the least awful outcome? I mean, something like Mr. Johnson's deal, with all of its possible threats to the peace process in Northern Ireland and to the integrity of the single market and customs union, or do they think that no deal and further extension is even worse than that?
Now, Mr. Johnson is legally obliged to ask for an extension. If he does, after all, do that, having insisted for weeks that he wouldn't, would that hurt him politically?
Well, it certainly wouldn't be as good for him as being able to turn around and have an election, say, aha, I got Britain out of the European Union October the 31st. But you can be sure that the people around Mr. Johnson, and let's remember who they are, they were the people behind the Vote Leave campaign that was so successful. Their pitch is going to be, isn't it? Look, I was determined to get it done. I wanted to get it done, but the EU stood in the way. You know, the opposition parties stood in the way, the judges. So he's going to fire up the 17.4 million people who voted Leave and say, come on, get behind me and let's give it another go.
Rob Watson. Finding a soulmate has become a big bucks business. In the United States alone, it's expected to be worth at least $3.2 billion this year. And it's not just in the Western world. China and India are big online daters too. The BBC has been investigating this multi-million dollar industry, and one of those it's spoken to is Verity Gear, a self-confessed dating addict whose book, The Man Detox, chronicles her journey through the world of dating apps, paid-for matchmaking services and dating agencies.
It has got to the point where if you really want to treat your dating life like Amazon Prime, you can go online and you can swipe on somebody and say that you like them. By the evening, you could be on a date with them. And later that evening, should everything go according to plan, you could be between the sheets with them. And that is how disposable dating has become. We have started to treat the dating world like our shopping. And it's that easy to meet somebody. And I know I'm not alone. I've got a friend in LA, a friend in Sydney. We were all doing it and all talking to each other about who we were meeting and what we were doing. And there is this element of, you've got to keep dating to find the right one. I call myself a dating junkie, where you get so caught up in how many different dates you can go on. You know, you can have a tall one one day, a short one the next day, a blue-eyed one the next day. Do you know what I mean? It's that easy to kind of whittle through the dates and try and find Mr. Right.
Serial data, Verity Gear. Now, here's another problem women face. Female theatregoers often face a dilemma during the interval, especially here in London. Get a drink or go to the toilet. There often isn't enough time to do both because there aren't enough toilets to avoid long queues. A theatre in London has made changes in an attempt to improve things, but many people still aren't happy, as Jonathan Savage explains.
When the curtain falls at interval time, the race begins. The women's hurdles from the theatre stalls to the bathroom stalls. At London's Old Vic, a $123,000 investment announced last year was designed to double the number of cubicles available for women and girls. The problem is, the number reserved for women and girls has been reduced to zero. You see, while stand-up urinals are still in place, the bathroom stalls, doubled in number to 44, are now for everyone.
The sheer embarrassment and awkwardness of it, women having to do what are really essentially private activities in front of a male audience.
That's urban planning expert Professor Clara Greed expressing the displeasure felt by many.
It depends on the design of the toilets, whether they're totally enclosed with walls and doors down to the floor, because otherwise there's lots of noise issues and embarrassment issues and smells issues. There's still shared washing and queuing areas, and many women are just very uneasy about personal safety. But also you've got to consider issues such as menstruation and the fact that women like privacy and having separate washing facilities.
The Old Vic says their toilets, including the urinals, are no longer designated male or female. They're self-selection, and insist they give a lot of thought to what they call a complex issue that goes beyond traditional definitions of gender. Theatre producer Amber Massey-Blomfield thinks this is great progress.
I suppose the big thing they're thinking about is people who identify as trans or non-binary or genderqueer. And we know that these are people who are the most vulnerable in our society. The sort of research from organisations like Gender Intelligence and Stonewall is that having gender-neutral toilets can be really beneficial to these communities, can help them feel safe, can help them do what they need to do in comfort.
With the Old Vic asking for feedback from their customers, the row over restrooms is likely to rage on. But after all, what is theatre without a little drama?
Jonathan Savage there. After a miserable start to life that included being shot at, kept in a chicken cage and suffering malnutrition, a baby orangutan called Gohanna is now well on the way to recovery. Last year, Gohanna was handed over to the Four Paws Orangutan Forest School. Weighing less than 2 kilograms and close to death, the orangutan has since made an incredible recovery. Indeed, he may even be able to return to the wild one day. Dr. Senior Proyshoft works at Four Paws. She says that like other apes, orangutans have a very strong will to live.
It doesn't really take too much. You just need to give them food and love, and then they do the rest by themselves. With Gohanna, we got an emergency call from the local authorities, and they asked us to pick him up the next day. And when things like that happen, we never really know how bad the situation is of the orphan that we are going to pick up. What we saw right away was that he was just a handful and really at the brink of death. It was only after he had stabilized and we were able to conduct some general health exams, including an X-ray, the big surprise was to find this air rifle bullet embedded in his skin. We take in orangutans that have been victimized by conflicts with humans. We want to give them back alive in freedom in their natural habitat. It depends how old they are when they come to us. And that predicts how long they stay in our care, because Gerhana, for instance, he came at the age of 8 months. And it means that he will probably stay with us in the forest school for something like 7 more years. And then he's reaching the age where he slowly would become independent from his mother if he still had one. And that's the age when it's possible to make them more independent from the human care.
Dr. Signe Preuschhoft.
And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.